No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show that will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us at BBSRADIO1 and the number 1. And I hope you'll call in tonight because we're going to be talking about some important stuff connected with the election coming up. But before we get started, first let me say hello to Maria. Hi, Maria.
Hello, Senator.
We were off last week. I'm okay. Yeah. How are you?
I'm actually pretty good, frankly. Good. It's been a wild time. I've seen clients now as part of my education. And some part of me, as my eyes well up with tears with the suffering that goes on, I'm like, what was I thinking?
Well, is this part of a practicum that you're seeing clients, or is
that's exactly correct?
Yeah, it's
part of the Behavioral Board of Sciences licensing for the state of California, as well as for Pepperdine to graduate. So, bring it on! Here we go.
Well, I know you'll do great at it.
Thank you.
But before we start, I want to go. You know, we're going to talk about the election in sort of a circuitous way tonight, talking about what we, you know, talking about what this election means and what's going to happen afterwards, rather than just focusing on the candidates, which everybody else seems to be doing anyway. I don't think we need to focus anymore. But before we start, I want to talk just briefly about the election here in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, because we have a very important issue on the ballot. We have an advisory referendum asking Washingtonians if they want to be the 51st state. And this is very important to us because statehood would make the people of the District of Columbia equal for the very first time. And what the ballot says is it puts forth a referendum which puts the four parts required by the Constitution to become a state on the ballot. And that is an acceptance of the idea of statehood, accepting the boundaries of the new state, accepting a constitution which was written over the summer and passed by the D.C. Council and the D.C. Statehood Commission, of which I am a member, and finally to accept a Republican or representative form of government. So those four issues are going to be on the ballot, and you either get to say yes or no. You can't say, yes, I want to be a state, but I don't want to be a Republican form of government. You can't say, yes, I want to be a state, or no, I don't want to be a state, but I accept the boundaries. You either take the whole package or you don't. So I encourage people to get out there in the District of Columbia and vote yes on referendum B. And with this information, we will go to the new Congress and new President of the United States, whoever that may be, and say that the District of Columbia not only demands statehood, but we're ready for it. We've passed the Constitution, we've agreed to the boundaries, and we're ready to go. So please go out there and vote. Vote for what everybody should vote. This is a very important election.
Regardless. And now what's, you know, as a little backup to what Shadow Politics once was, and then when you so cordially, and by the way, it's been over a year since I've been honored to be your co-host.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, can you imagine?
She got a prize or something.
But in 2009, when the Democrats controlled both the presidency and both houses of Congress, that's as close as the District of Columbia came to ever gaining what it is that you're looking for. And it didn't happen then. But what I found interesting, because I did a little bit of research about what it is that you're asking for, apparently, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the District of Columbia would elect a governor, not a mayor, and right. you would have a 21-seat state legislature instead of your present 13-person council.
Exactly.
And that the land that the White House, the Capitol, and the National Mall are on would be carved out as an independent federal enclave. And so right. that would separate those properties from the District of Columbia. And then also that you aren't taxing people. I mean, you are taxed those who live in the city, mm-hmm. and that the income that you earn and the commuter tax would be a non-issue anymore for folks, let's say, in Maryland or Virginia.
Well, it would be an issue for them because it would probably be a commuter tax, but it's really not an issue to them in the sense that any taxes they would pay would be rebated to them by their own state. But that's generally how it's done.
I see.
If you work in New Jersey and you pay a tax because you live in Pennsylvania, then you get to take that off your Pennsylvania taxes. But it does impact the state, the funding for the state. And, you know, it's a big issue for us because 40% of the people that, and I'm sure this is true most other places too, 40% of the people that live in work in the city don't live in the city. But unfortunately here, if you work in, you know, if you live in outside LA, but you work in LA, California still gets your tax money.
Right.
Here, if you live in Virginia and you work in Washington, Virginia gets your tax money. So it's a relatively big issue for us. And yeah, and the reason we carve out the federal enclave is because the Constitution requires that the seat of government be controlled by Congress. So we go, great, just make sure the seat of government is the seat of government and it's not the surrounding residential areas. So we've cut out the seat of government. Congress would still have control over it. They've always had control over it. We become a separate entity just like everybody else in America. You really got to be a state in the United States to be equal because that's the way the government was set up.
Well, and so what I've said is or read is that you have 670,000 people. Is that correct?
Yes, 675,000 people. Yes.
Okay. So some people may say, because the county that I live in has more than that. And my Republican representative said, why would we give D.C. two when we don't, our county doesn't even have two. But your population is more than the state of Vermont or the state of Wyoming.
Right. Both. So bigger than Wyoming, bigger than Vermont, you know, and there has been talk over the years in returning us to Maryland, but nobody in Maryland wants to do that. Nobody in D.C. wants to do it, so it's a non-starter. But other than that, yeah, we would be among the smallest state. We'd be the third smallest state in population, maybe the smallest in land area. But there are 12 states that have less of a gross domestic product than we do. And there are 21 states that pay less federal taxes than we do. So we're kind of right in there.
So here's the other thing, though, is that because the Democrats outnumber the Republicans 12-1 in the research that I did in the District of Columbia, I see why this is polarizing.
Right.
But the fact that you couldn't get it done in 2009 when you had the perfect storm, what makes you think that you can get it done now in spite of the vote on the referendum?
Well, it's not so much a matter of thinking we can get it done, okay, as it is that you got to do something, right? You can't accept this situation that we have where we have no representation. We're the only country in the world that does this. You know, it's kind of like saying to some, you know, saying to Rosa Parks, what made you think that giving your seat up on, not giving your seat up on the bus was going to start a firestorm? She probably didn't know that, but you have to do something, right? She got sick and tired of giving up her seat on the bus, and she said no. So that's what we're saying. We're sick and tired of this, and we're going to take action. What happens, whether that action is successful or not, is you know, a different question altogether. We don't know if we'll be successful. And the advisory referendum doesn't do anything more than allow us to say the people of D.C. have our backs. But the truth of the matter is, Rosa Parks did not change the bus system in Montgomery, Alabama. The people that didn't ride the buses for 381 days are the people that changed the bus, you know, the segregated bus system in Montgomery. So that's kind of the idea here, is that when the people get behind something, it tends to give it momentum. And that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to get the people behind this to give it momentum. But yeah, there's no reason to believe. We were outmaneuvered in 2009 because what happened was it passed in the House in the previous it did not pass in the House in the previous Congress, but passed in the Senate. So when we took control of the House and passed it in the House, we just thought it would be a slam dunk in the Senate. In the Senate. And we took it over to the Senate, and the National Rifle Association put a kind of a heinous gun bill, connected it to a guy named Ensign, who was a senator from Nevada, attached it to the bill. And so we defeated the bill. We killed it because the bill, the amendment said that not only could you carry automatic weapons across the street from the White House, but we wouldn't be able to ever pass another gun law in the District of Columbia. And we saw that as too much to give up for one vote. So we actually killed the bill. And that was a matter of being outmaneuvered. But, there's no reason to believe this is going to make us a state overnight. The only thing is it gives us a little more backing to stand up and say, look, this has got to change. Because I could tell you on Capitol Hill, they stand against us because it is a partisan issue, but they don't come right out and stand up to us because they understand this is the principle on which the country was founded. So people that oppose us say things like, well, you need to amend the Constitution, or you need to do this, or you need to do that. But if we get some momentum behind this, it's going to be really hard for them to tell a veteran that went to Iraq and Afghanistan that he can't have the same rights as the people that live in Maryland and Virginia. So
have you really looked into being absorbed by the surrounding states?
Yeah, by Maryland. Yeah. Going back to Maryland, but they have to agree to it, which they don't want to agree to, because again, you have the same partisan problem. Why would the Republican Party of Maryland want to get, 350,000 new Democrats? And why would, it's funny that Washington, D.C. is bigger than any city in Maryland. The only city in Maryland that's even close to the size of the district is Baltimore. And Baltimore has about 50,000 less people than Washington, D.C. So you would also double the urban population of Maryland. And, people that live in the suburbs aren't going to like that. There's a lot of resistance to the idea. So, yeah, we've looked into it. And actually, there's precedent for it because in the 1840s, we gave Virginia back their part of the city because they were afraid, some wealthy landowners were afraid that we were going to end slavery in the district. And we did. We were the first people to end slavery, first jurisdiction. So they wanted out, and we let them out. So there's even precedent for it. But, yeah, Maryland doesn't want it.
Sounds like you should just get adopted by California, somehow jump across the country.
So cool. Well, somebody said that. Somebody said, why go to Why go to Maryland? Why not go to Alaska? They get that nice oil subsidy. You know, they all get
a
subsidy from the oil companies. But yeah, California. Yeah, if we got like free trips to San Diego, you know, how great it would be to be an elected official and have to come to, you know, Sacramento.
I'm thinking San Francisco. I mean, you want to talk about brothers and sisters in arms or like-minded.
Yeah.
We have in the state of California over 400 tax and debt proposals on our ballot. In my county, there are 17 alone. They had to send out the voter guide is super thick and costs so much. But they're saying that if these passed, something like I've got it here somewhere about 13.6, the tax increases of more than $13.6 billion a year on all the proposals that are on the ballot.
Well, and, you know,
as if we don't tax enough already. We're one of the highest in every regard.
Well, that's one of my problems when people talk about a multi-party system and they say, you know, the Republicans and Democrats have gotten too much alike and we should go to a system where you've got 20 different parties like you have in Italy. The Italians are a great democracy. They let everybody run the country for a couple of weeks and then they put in a new government. But that's one of the problems, right? You end up with 40 referendums on the ballot. You end up with, with a basic two-party system, those things are being funneled as they get to the national level. They're funneled through the party, and you don't have 10 different positions on every issue. You have two major positions. That's something we've got to talk about tonight. So let's get into it. I mean, this election, they just did a poll. I think this is the most depressing number I've heard with all the polls. You know, how many polls are we seeing a day now? But they did a poll that showed 82% of the American people said they're disgusted over this campaign. Now, first of all, I've been in politics a long time, and 82% of the American people agreeing on anything is a really amazing, amazing number.
That's a nice way of putting it.
there are very few issues that 82% of Americans agree on, but they certainly have agreed. They've agreed on this, and you know, I think I don't know what we do about this. You know, and politics has always been dirty. I don't know if people understand this, American politics, but in the election of 1800, for example, surrogates for it was an election between the then president John Adams and his vice president Thomas Jefferson, and their surrogates in Adams' case. The surrogates said that if Jefferson was elected, your wife and daughters would become victims of legal prostitution, and there would be murder, rape, adultery, and incest everywhere, and it would be illegal. Whereas Jefferson's surrogates called Adams a warmongering liar who was repulsive, and a gross hypocrite, and they called him a hermaphrodite.
You're kidding.
They said he was neither man nor woman. He had the personality. Yeah. I mean, it's always been bad. And even a more famous story is Andrew Jackson. You know, Andrew Jackson's wife was married for one day to a cousin, which wasn't that unusual in those days. It was an arranged marriage. And after one day, where the marriage was never consummated, they never even were together. They were in different states, I believe. The marriage was annulled. Well, when Jackson ran for president, they called his wife an adulteress because she had been married. And she died a few days after he took office. And Jackson would never deal with the press after that.
Is that right?
Yeah, he said that they had hounded her to death. And in fact, he had a niece who was a barmaid, and she was a rather tawdry barmaid from all all reports. Yeah, in Washington D.C. And he used to take her all to all the White House functions with
him. You're kidding.
As his official date, yeah, because it would annoy people like Dolly Madison, and the kind of there had developed this kind of hierarchy, especially among the women in pecking order in Washington society. And he also blamed Washington society for what happened to his wife. So he used to love to bring this barmaid with this uneducated kind of barmaid with him just to annoy, the people that were in power, because they, people like Dolly Madison saw it as really unseemly. So it's always been dirty. I don't know if we get the dirt out of it, but there's part of me that thinks we should have evolved from the 1800s into something better.
You know what's funny, though, Michael? It speaks to the human condition.
Yeah.
Regardless of how much we know, how sophisticated we may believe we are, how intelligent, how better educated, technology, etc., at the base, we're all human beings. And apparently there are some impulses that are just native, if you will, or organic, that transcend time. So what people are doing now, I love the examples that you provided, because it does kind of put it into perspective. But what we need to do on Wednesday or at midnight on November 8th or whenever they're going to call it, is we need to heal. And what I have done in the last two cycles, when the President Obama was elected, I said, the people have spoken.
Yeah,
the process unfolded, and that's what the majority of folks said, and so be it. And now we need to move forward and accept what is and do what we can within the confines of the election and the results.
Right. And I hope we're able to do that as a country. And I think you're right. I think it is part of the human condition. And I often say that the worst news and the best news about democracy are the same news, and that is that it represents the people. And I think that's what bothers me most about this, is that this election does represent the people, and we're so divided. No matter who wins here, the country is so divided. And the thing that bothers me most about the commercials that I'm seeing on TV is they're all about the other person's character. They're not talking about the issues, and the issues are important here, and people should understand there are differences. Let me just run down real quickly so people know. On immigration, there's a drastic difference between Clinton, who wants to have a pathway to immigration for the 11 million undocumented immigrants, and Trump, who says no. On gun control, she wants background checks. He doesn't. She supports an assault weapon ban. He doesn't. On the war on terrorism, he wants to increase military spending, but she says no. On NAFTA, she's for NAFTA. He's not. And that's an important piece of trade legislation. I mean, these are important differences between them. Abortion, yes, she supports legal abortion. He does not. LGBT rights, he doesn't support same-sex marriage, but she does. There are many things. On the economy, she wants to raise the minimum wage. He doesn't. He wants to replace Obamacare. She doesn't. These are major issues that people should be concerned about, and it really, they're not even talking about them. They're just saying, look, he's so terrible, and he's saying she's so terrible. And
I appreciate what you're saying, because it really should be about the issues and what they stand for. Yeah. But I think this is a little more unique in its perspective, in that people are saying, what is at the top flows down and water seeks its own level and that sort of thing. And maybe we are more concerned this time around with character and with integrity than we were before, because one would assume that if somebody has character and integrity, they're going to make choices that are congruent with those values. And maybe that's why there's the finger pointing this time around, because it is an issue.
Well, I think there's always been the finger pointing too. You know, I mean, when what Jefferson's calling Adams a hermaphrodite, and you know, through his surrogates, and they were notoriously close. You know, I mean, they died on the same day, right? And that was Jefferson's last word, supposedly, is that Adams lives, because he didn't realize that Adams had just passed away a few hours before he did. But you know, and they both died on the July the 4th, you know, which is an amazing fact to me. But anyway, I mean, there's always been a character thing, but I don't begrudge them that in the discussion, but that's all the discussion this time.
But think about, you know, Ronald Reagan was married to Jane Wyman and had two children, right? Did that really ever come up in the campaign? I think that was a non-issue.
I don't remember it coming up.
I don't either.
And that's what I mean. You know, the fact that John F. Kennedy was a Catholic was a big campaign issue. But mm-hmm. that wouldn't be an issue today. You know,
no.
I mean, we've gone beyond that, right? And it wouldn't be an issue. It wouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, because Trump's three marriages don't seem to really be part of the discourse. You know, it's his locker room talk that got him in trouble here, not the fact that he's married three women.
Well, if you had to count on the divorce vote to get elected, that's a pretty substantial vote in America. You know, we've changed in that regard too. But yeah, you're right. There's certain issues that are just off the table anymore. And
even drug use, I think, is probably a non-issue now.
Yeah,
that
and
may
remember
change.
The guy from Missouri, what was his name? Eagleton, who was the vice presidential candidate, and he cried. Remember that? And he dropped out of the race because he had once cried.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, how crazy is that? And
well, wasn't it Mondale who had electroshock therapy? And that was.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So, I mean, but those were blips, I think, on the radar. I don't think they were focuses. And I honestly, Michael, this conversation that we're having right now is why more, quote, normal people don't run for office, because who the heck wants a microscope going up their butt?
Well, it's true. I mean, it's tough. It's a tough thing to do. And if they can't find stuff, they make stuff up.
Or they exaggerate it, or, you know, say, well, if that was the case, then this must have been what's happening, like the law of association or what have you. But it's so, I mean, I know that Colin Powell has always says that Alma has said, no, you can't run for office because I don't want to go through that process. No,
well,
thank you.
You know, if there's somebody out there that has great character that we'd like to get to run for office, is somebody like Powell, you know.
Yes.
And unfortunately, that's true. I think you find that from a lot.
Well, how about Condoleezza Rice?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Those are exemplary Republicans who are not right wing Christian in their approach. And Powell has endorsed Democrats how many times now? Three, right? Obama twice and Hillary. You know, you want to talk about going across the aisle, and yet they won't even put their hat in the ring.
Right. And you know, a guy like Powell has also phenomenally worked for both sides. You know,
yes.
He's worked in both Republican and Democratic administrations. And certainly that's the kind of person you wanted, but we've gotten so split right down the middle that, you know, it's really troublesome, I think. And,
here's some good news, I think, in that regard, and it's with our Supreme Court. So there's something called courtesy votes.
Yeah.
And in August, Justice Stephen Breyer broke with his colleagues on the liberal side to give the fifth vote against a high school senior who's the transgender be able to use a bathroom of which he identifies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then late Thursday, So that's just this week. We had Chief Justice John Roberts doing the same thing. He switched sides to stay the execution of inmate Tommy Arthur, convicted for the murder for hire of a woman's husband. And they say that those two votes in emergency appeals offer a rare peek behind the curtain that the court can still function collegially.
Well, you know, and
that's in this day and age.
And certainly in the long run, for the bigger picture, I think that that's exactly who's going to have to lead the way. It's going to have to be our leaders, you know, that bring us together. And they're going to have to do it by doing the kind of things that you just said. You know, they're
and they're doing it today. This isn't ancient news. This isn't election cycle. This is pre-election that this is going down. So to me, I'm thinking as divisive and as divided as we appear, the truth is behind the scenes, we're still functioning and we're functioning well.
Well, I hope is more the Kate, more the rule than the exception. But, you know, what worries me is the aftermath of how we're going to bring people together with the country so divided. I look at the politics, for example, and I say to myself, one thing that really worries me, if Hillary Clinton wins, the Republicans in Congress, in order to heal their own party, in order to reconcile with the Trump people, are going to feel obliged to go after her. Because that's the one place where they will meet, right? The Trump people have problems with the Republican Party, of which they're members. They have problems with the Republican establishment. And the only way the Republican establishment is going to be able to appease them, in the least, is to come after Hillary if she gets elected. Because they're going to expect that. They're going to want that. So that kind of thing bothers me. How are we going to deal with that? And how is the party going to deal with it? And likewise, if Trump gets elected, I don't think the Democratic Party will be as fractionalized, but certainly the Bernie Sanders people, you know, there's an element of that with inside the Democratic Party too, where the young people are going to say, hey, look, man, this was your fault. You should have put, we should have put Bernie up there. We should have put Joe Biden. We should have had a better, right? And so I think there'll be problems for the Democrats too. I think it's bigger for the Republicans though to hold their party.
It is bigger. It is bigger. And it's actually fundamentally foundational shifting perhaps, because what we've been doing isn't working again. It's not like this has just happened once. So that's where I try and get realistic with the folks in my party, is stop with putting morality on the party platform. Stop right. with having abortion be a part of what makes somebody a Republican. Stop right. those social issues that have nothing to do with politics and government.
Well, you know, we went through a similar thing where we had Mondale and Dukakis, and, you know, and these guys were holdovers from the traditional liberal wing of the party. And then Clinton came along. When Clinton first came along, he was promoted to a thing called the Democratic Leadership Council. And we used to call them they were a client of mine. And we used to call them the Republican Democrats because they
really?
Were the more, yeah, because they were the more conservative Democrats. They were guys like Sam Nunn of Georgia and Al Gore of Tennessee. And look at how those guys, they rose through power through the DLC. Clinton, Nunn too, and Gore. But, you know, Clinton attacked welfare when he got elected. That was a sacred cow inside the Democratic Party. I mean, it was like gun control in the Republican Party. It was something that politicians, welfare people danced around it and they talked about it, but they didn't want to mess with it. It was, an 800-pound gorilla politically. And when Clinton reformed the welfare system, we, all us traditional liberals, flipped out. We went, oh, you know, but it helped bring our party back a little bit to the center, and that helped.
Well, let's not forget when you dropped the death penalty from your party platform.
Right.
That, to me, was what galvanized you the most.
But isn't it funny that we're just talking about issues, and we dropped it from the party platform, but that's one of the things that both Clinton and Trump support, is the death penalty.
Well, we've got it on our ballot in California to make it obsolete.
Yeah.
The death penalty.
Yeah. It's a complicated issue. I work for the National Coalition to Ban the Death Penalty, and it's a complicated issue because there are, you know, people that are put to death by mistake, and it is cruel and unusual punishment in a lot of ways. But I got it, you know, it's hard to feel sorry, even though you know the person's sick. It's hard to feel sorry for some guy that murdered his whole family or went out into the neighborhood and, you know, raped and killed little kids or, you know, whatever. Some of these crimes are guys end up, they're very heinous. And look what's happening. I mean, when you talk about the divide, I to bring it back to what we're talking about, you know, one of the things that bothers me is that on the one hand, you have this Black Lives Matter movement. We just had a protest a similar group called a Million Masked March here. Maybe you saw it. They vandalized the FBI building and they.
No, that missed me.
Yeah, it's well, in the cosmic scheme of things, it's probably not a big story. But since it happened here in Washington, we heard about it. They vandalized the FBI building and they also vandalized the Trump Hotel and they arrested two people. But, you know, you've got that going on the one hand, and then you've got nuts out shooting police officers.
Well, that's when the Blue Lives Matter.
Yeah, you just, you know, so how far apart can we get? We've got, you know, we've got one group that's, you know, consumed with police brutality, which does exist. But then we have another group that's perpetrating brutality on the police.
Yeah.
You know, it's just crazy that these two cops were murdered. Where were they, in Oklahoma? I can't remember.
Yet again.
Just shot in their police car, ambushed by this crazy guy.
Well, and then the ones, I mean, it's, we go on and on. And studying, they call it now DV, Michael, domestic violence, in my coursework, and those are the most volatile calls to respond to. Yeah. And they ended up turning on the officers that respond to it, which, you know, I mean, talk about held hostage or what have you. That to me, that's when you're talking, nobody kills who's in their right mind. I would say, make that statement, just like no one commits suicide who isn't well. Who's, you know, they're suffering. That's what afflicted people do. So ironically, California has a proposition to delete the death penalty because we haven't killed anybody since 2006. And then they also are considering going from the cocktail to one lethal dose of one product to do it. So we're having both of those conversations at the same time in the state. You want to talk about polarized? You know, I mean, and as Catholics, we're supposed to be against abortion and the death penalty because it's taking life, right? Well, one is, in my estimation, is innocent. The other is guilty, is an adult who made a decision to take the life of another. So I don't even know how the church can put those two together, but they do. So, I mean, we'll probably be arguing this for the rest of the dawn of time because I don't know how you really resolve it. It isn't a deterrent.
It
or
is.
Else people wouldn't be right. continue to be killing.
Right.
But I have to tell you, personally, I think it's enough of a deterrent, and it's a price that somebody should have to pay. And yes, I understand there have been innocent, but that has been the exception. And we are flawed, and that's horrible. Horrible to think that somebody was wrongly convicted and wrongly put to death. But it can't be the norm. It's got to be the outliers.
And you know, yeah, I mean, it's a very, very complicated issue, I think. And, yeah, I think, even though I'm against the death penalty, I am. I don't think that government has the right to impose it. There are people you can't cure, too. There are people that just can't cure.
That is correct.
Jeffrey Dahmer, I don't care how many psychologists you put in a room, you weren't going to cure Jeffrey Dahmer, I don't think. Or the handsome guy from Florida, I forget his name, who killed
Ted Bundy.
Ted Bundy, yeah, killed all those people.
How did I know who you were talking about?
I mean, you know, he was like, he looked like he was a tennis. He looked like he was a tennis pro or something, right? I mean, you wouldn't expect this. You expect a mass murderer, you know, that you'd be able to tell if you saw him. But this guy looked like somebody you wanted to have a drink with at the country club.
Well, Ann Rule wrote the book on him called "The Stranger Beside Me" because they worked at a hotline together as a volunteer. Philanthropically, yeah. And it was Ted Bundy.
Yeah. Well, I went to see F. Lee Bailey one time, who gave a lecture, and, you know, he was the attorney for the Boston Strangler. And he said that even that this guy was such a regular looking guy that even when they were on TV and on the radio in Boston warning women not to open their doors, that this guy never had a problem getting in. Nobody ever told him no. You know, he would come and pretend to be the gas man or a repairman of some type, and women let him in all the time because he just looked like, you know, like he was the gas man. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, you know, so I wonder what happens in all this, considering third-party candidates. You know, that's an interesting thing that I think we'll have to keep an eye on. Because
do you? Because last polls I heard, it was like 3% and 5% or something like that.
Well,
Jill Stein was getting 3%.
Yeah, Jill Stein is nationally getting 3%, and what's-his-name is getting
5%.
So Johnson is getting 5 to 6%. Right. But
it's not a Ross Perot. Let's just put it that way.
Look at Utah. It looks like that guy could win.
Yeah.
McCollum could win.
Yeah, I'm hearing that.
He's ahead of Trump and he's ahead of Clinton. And he's 7 points ahead of Clinton and 4 points ahead of Trump, which really says something. And this guy, Johnson, who I'm sorry, but I think automatically if they ask you the question, name one world leader, and you can't do it, you should automatically be disqualified. Right? You should be like, you need to go back to President Kennedy school, you know, and get a degree.
I'm just hoping, I don't know about you, Michael, I call it Halfheimer's, and I say that with all due respect for folks that, you know, have Alzheimer's, but I swear to goodness that I have brain farts and it's like embarrassing that, you know, something simple. And I'm like, you're kidding. I look and I stammer and I gaze off thinking, please, dear God, let it come to me. So I can't imagine how embarrassing that must have been for him.
That
is embarrassing.
It was embarrassing, but, you know, so, but the bottom line on him is in New Mexico, he's got 11% of the vote.
You're kidding.
And in between him and Stein in New Mexico, they've got almost 15% of the vote. So, I mean, this is – I don't know if it's coming of age, but, you know, we have had – Ralph Nader, I just participated, actually, got a letter from him this week, just participated in something that Ralph Nader did here in Washington on statehood. He's a big statehood advocate. But,
is he?
Yeah. But, yeah, he's lived here a long time. He just did a forum and streamed it live across the country, at Constitution Hall that I was involved in. But what's
your polling looking like?
What do you mean?
For your referendum?
We don't poll. We haven't polled for it. All we know is that 71% of the people that were registered voters when they were polled by the Post said they were for it. So we don't know. We haven't polled on the referendum. The people pushing it haven't put any money into it. They just, which is a mistake. They feel like, you know, the righteousness of the cause is going to carry the day. And I'm not sure that's true, but we're pushing along as much as we can. Yeah, they
don't... surprised that you wouldn't have some grassroots money coming in. I mean, because as you've mentioned on prior broadcasts, this will be an endorsement for you to move forward. But if it doesn't pass, then you're kind of just like out in the fields.
Oh, yeah. It's a big problem if it doesn't pass. If it doesn't pass, it really sets the movement back. And we fought that. We fought that in order to try to get them to put money into it. But they really don't. You know, one of the problems with, and again, this is a political problem in Washington with the politicians. They don't really get anything out of it. They've got a $9 billion budget that they control right now. The people that get something out of being a state are the people that live here.
Right.
You know, they get two senators and a representative and that get a vote.
Well, and a 21-person council.
But those 13 guys don't want to add another.
Oh, give up that control and power.
Yeah. They're happy. They have a $9 billion budget. I mean, in New Hampshire, they have a 434-member legislature, and they have like a $5 billion budget, which means that each person on the legislature gets control of about $100 million, assuming that everything were equal, right? In D.C., we have a $13 billion budget with 13-member council, so each one of our members, all things considered, gets $1 billion to work with, 10 times as much. And you know what? We are the highest paid city council in America, with the exception of Los Angeles.
I was just going to say.
And the difference, there's two differences with Los Angeles. First of all, Los Angeles is a full-time job.
Yeah.
In Washington, you can make $130,000 a year as a member of the city council, and you can have outside employment. Some people make as much as $200,000 on the side and working for city contractors.
Isn't that a conflict of interest?
Yeah, well, evidently it's not a conflict of interest here.
Well, you guys write your own rules there.
Right, we write our own rules. So, it's really more about the people in D.C. than it is about the politicians. And so they go at this half-heartedly, unfortunately.
Well, then the people had better speak.
Yes, they have to speak. So
I'm really going to be following this. And since you're 3 hours ahead and your polls close sooner, we should have some answers before we have to go to bed here on the West Coast.
Yeah, either they're very quick or there's some screw up and it takes forever. But usually they're pretty quick about it. Some of the other things, though, that I think this is an election that's going to be analyzed for a long time. You look at early voting, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, early voting's so way up. And is that because early voting is catching on? Or is it because people think this is a really important election and they want to make sure they vote? Or is it because people are sick of it? That I hear that more than anything from people.
Speaking about that, though, it makes me think of other countries where Election Day is a national holiday, or in Mexico, where they vote on Saturdays. But there's a trend that I didn't realize that includes General Motors and Ford Motor Company. They're closed for the entire day.
That's exactly right.
Folks are starting their the smaller employees, the small business owners, if you will, are giving flex time, or they're offering balloting breaks, or they're opening late, like at 10 a.m. Yep. And they're saying, go and vote, which I think is unbelievable. And unfortunately, it's asking entrepreneurs and or businesses to do what I think our government should do.
Right.
Let's give everybody the day off, or move it to a weekend.
I think we should do it too. And I was just going to say that because I just read an article about how Patagonia, the outdoor store, they've closed all their stores nationwide on Tuesday. So their employees can have the whole day off to vote. And you're right. The national government should be doing that. And I can tell you, it's funny, in D.C., we do it. polling places. We have 132 polling places in the city, which is, I'm sorry, 142.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. I campaigned for Kerry out on Indian reservations, and it's 45-minute drive from one polling station to another polling station. In D.C., they're across the street from each other.
My
polling station is directly across the street from an elementary school, which is another polling station. My polling station.
Well, you have a bunch of volunteers then that are needed for that.
A ton.
And that's a long day, too, because my mom does it as an English as a second language. She volunteers, yeah. So she speaks Spanish, and she's in her 80s, and she has to be there like at 6 because the polls open at 7.
Yeah.
Then they close at 8, and they have to stay until whenever the ballots are collected or distributed or what have you. I mean, and for anybody, and they get a whopping, stipend for that?
Yeah.
You know, no one does it for the money.
Right. No one does it for the money. But, you know, and I got to tell you, I've campaigned outside the most popular elementary school in Washington, where every politician sends at least 4 or 5 poll workers, right? And we scare the hell out of the kids. These are little kids, you know, some of them are in kindergarten and pre-K, and they're coming with their little backpacks, and everybody out there screaming at each other. Vote for Joe, vote for Charlie, vote for, and these kids are like, oh my God. Well, you know? So I don't know why we don't call it off. You know,
I'm not sure, Michael. Do you know the history about that? Like, I mean, because it's really asking for more privilege to be able to vote, because those folks who have jobs and who have children and who need childcare, who need transportation, all the things that regular folks might not have at their disposal, it's skewing it against them.
Yes. And yes, it is. And that's another reason we should do it. We should give it, you know, because I vote in every election and have since I've been able to vote.
But
I worked with a lot of people back in the day. You know, I've worked since I was 14 years old, and I worked with people back in the day who were minimum wage employees who didn't vote because they couldn't take the time off.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. They
it's almost
go.
Prejudicial.
Yeah, it really is. Well, I got to tell you, we're running out of time here, Marie. I can't believe it, because we still had a lot of things to talk about. But one thing I want to say before we leave tonight is that everybody should get out there and vote.
Yes.
And I have a profound belief in the Almighty, and I believe that He watches over all of us. So I ask you, if you're out there listening, I don't care what God you pray to or what religion you are, but say a prayer for America, because we really need to be watched over right now. And I want to leave a minute or two early so that we can play a classic by Ray Charles, America the Beautiful, so that we all remember, is there an American out there that wouldn't say, thank God I was born here. Thank God I live here. This is the most wonderful country in the world. Let's not forget that. And Maria, you have the last word.
I can't echo your sentiments enough and more. And again, Michael and I respectfully disagree on certain topics and subjects, as does most of us. But that isn't what unites us, our differences. It's what we have in common, and democracy is one of them. And you can't continue to have that if you don't participate in the process. And let's make sure whoever gets elected on November 8th represents the majority of us. So if you are registered to vote, please vote, so that whomever ends up in the White House did have the bulk of America behind them, not the minority or not the exception and not the fringe and not the fanatics.
Okay, America, we'll see you next week. Don't forget to vote. I always give Maria the last word, and then I take the last word. I'm sorry. sorry about that. But please go out and vote. Thanks.
Yes,
we'll
thank
see you next
have
week.
Have a great week.
Oh, beautiful, far heroes proved in liberating strife. Who more than self
Give the people their right to vote.